Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Leaders in Value Chain podcast. I'm your host, Radu Palamariu, and very happy to have with us today Dr. Kjell Nordstrom, who many of you know as being a prominent thinker, writer, lecturer. He's been writing books for a long, long time. I remember, it's been a while since I read Karaoke Capitalism. I think it was 2003, right, Dr. Kjell, that you published that one. That was one of my favorite books at the time. So glad to have you with us today. We will be talking about your, I wanted to say latest book, but it's second latest book, which is Momentum, which you published last year, where you talk about how the world has changed, how the world has been affected by the pandemic, the climate crisis, and the war in Ukraine. So I'd love to pick your brains on a few of the main topics. And I also want to talk a little bit with you from your latest book, which you just shared with me, from Crisis, from Paul, The Monkey and the Money, which is a book in which you follow the flow of and the history of capitalism and money over time. And I also have a couple of questions on that one. So with that, love to start. And thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So maybe let's start with the Momentum book. Yeah, so there's a lot of different topics in the book, but maybe let's start with the big question. What prompted you to write Momentum in the first place? And what was kind of the theme that you wanted to address, big picture?
I think we have to go back to the corona crisis, because immediately when the corona pandemic was a fact, and we grounded all the planes and all the supply chains of the world, particularly the international ones, were severely affected. It was quite clear to me and my colleagues that I'm talking to, research colleagues, that these disruptions will change the business landscape and even the political landscape forever. And that's why I started to look into, now, what is it that we can see ahead of us, given these disruptions that Corona initiated? I couldn't dream of the fact that 1.5 years later, we would have a war on our doorstep here in Europe, and a number of other disruptions in the world economy. But it was indeed the Corona, the virus, that initiated the process, the thinking.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, we will probably be referring to before and after, and we're already kind of starting to talk about that. I know that one of the key themes in the book, how has Corona impacted, is a big one. The other one is on the side of climate. You call it, I think, Climate Express. We are the climate. I think that's the title in the book, the title of the chapter.
Yes.
Love to pick some of the main themes and how you see this developing in the next years, because it seems to be an emergency for some. Some still live in denial, as far as I can say, my subjective opinion. Love to hear your perspective.
Okay. My perspective here is, number one, it's difficult to talk about the future because we can't do proper research on the future. But what we can do is, of course, to consult a witch. And there is something like a witch. And the witch is the global automotive industry, cars. It's the world's most competitive industry. It's the world's most well-researched industry. We know everything about them. It's an industry that everybody has a relation to. It's a politically sensitive industry. There is nothing actually in the world today that compares to the competitive pressure that you find in that industry. Mm. This also means that they, for 70, 80 years, have been very innovative. They have been in the forefront when it comes to the development of, well, look at lean, that they invented end of the 60s, that is still considered a new cool thing in some countries and industries. And they did it in the 60s. Personalization of cars, they have been doing for 50 years. Try to personalize a hotel experience and they will tell you, no, 12 o'clock you check out, 12 o'clock you check in. Cars are made for you. It's your Mini Cooper. It's an extremely, extremely innovative industry. Not because they are special people, they have to in order to survive. Electrification is today a fact. And they are in the forefront. Tesla is now 22 years. It's not a two-year-old company. It's a 22-year-old company that has driven a complete change of automotive. Everybody is going electric. And here's the message. If they go electric, tractors go electric, ferry boats will go electric, small helicopters, airplanes, everything will go electric. All the sub-suppliers will be go green because they have to. All the steel makers will be forced to go green because they have to. Otherwise, Volkswagen won't buy anything and you and I won't buy the end product. So now the pressure is on. The usual story is that the automotive industry breaks through and then the rest of us follows. And I would say the race has now started. You and I were talking about Northvolt earlier this morning, a battery manufacturer in the north of Scandinavia in Sweden, one of the world's biggest battery manufacturers that are ramped up as we're speaking. But right in the same neighborhood where Northvolt is investing, a green steel effort is now made, which is huge. Fertilizers, greening, going green. There is a massive industrial cluster moving in that direction. This is only the beginning. The Chinese will not be able to sell any steel whatsoever in Europe from 2026 if it's not green, which means that they will be out. Half of the steel makers in Europe will be forced into bankruptcy if they don't fulfill the green criteria as of 2026. So the change has started. Banks, insurance companies, schools, universities, all of us will now be driven into a race, and the race is to reach zero first or below zero when it comes to carbon dioxide. I have never seen such a rapid industrial transformation as the one we see now, led by automotive industry, and it has happened in just a handful of years.
I had a conversation just yesterday with a friend of mine, German. Automotive, if we look at Europe, one of the strongest, the strongest automotive industry, I would argue, is in Germany. He was a bit pessimistic, and I'm also a bit pessimistic. When I look at the pace of change and innovation that comes from China when it comes to cars, and so, okay, Tesla and China. Let's just put this too. There's some others, of course, I'm simplifying here. As opposed to perhaps the speed with which some of the German auto manufacturers, I think Volvo has done a pretty good job. I actually know Jim Rohn, who's the CEO. I think they've done very well and they have some really aggressive targets. So that's to be celebrated. But when you look at the, let's say for the sake of simplicity, German automakers, I think there's a speed. There's almost like they're in gear two and there's some others that are in gear four or five. How do you see this playing out also with the repercussions that this could have? Because if, we start seeing mostly Chinese-made cars in Europe, let's say, that means that a lot of that industry has, and a lot of the money flow goes somewhere else. It doesn't stay in Europe anymore. Any thoughts around this?
David Attenborough, the BBC filmmaker, once said, climate change, you see, nature don't have a problem. We have a problem.
Yeah.
And I would say it's the same with the German automotive industry. The automotive industry don't have a problem. Germany has a problem and Mercedes has a problem. And if you're German, maybe you think it's a problem. But if you see it from a global point of view, the drift of innovation, the drive of new products, the level of innovation, nothing, no bad news, just good news. It's massive innovation going on in the automotive industry. Germany might have a problem. BMW might have a problem. That's a problematic for them. But the global automotive industry is racing ahead with the Chinese and Tesla and some other players now in the forefront. There will be a response from the Chinese, from the Germans, from Japan, of course, and from other automotive manufacturers. But it's just a part of the game. It's another discussion whether this is good or bad geopolitically or for Europe, but innovation, my God, is going on. And electrification, yes. Yes. Faster than ever. The Germans are slow, unfortunately.
You also talk in the book about what you call an executive storyteller and leading with words. And I wanted to a little bit double click on that part, because we also about a year ago put out a book specifically for value chain leaders, in which we encourage them, and we said chain model, and N stands for narrative. Is exactly, I think it's exactly what you're also pinpointing. So I wanted to platform to share also what you think and why you think that executive storytelling skill is so key.
Yes, I mean, we are now in dire times, in the sense that we have a war going on in Europe and we have had the corona crisis. Now, at any point in time when we human beings are confronted with the crisis, leadership, political leadership, industrial leadership, of course, becomes an issue to navigate through the crisis. And every time this happens, we are reminded of the fact that there are three different ways to lead people. You can either command them and force them, let's call it the sword. You can bribe them, give them money, let's call it the money. Or you can try to convince them with words. Tell them a story, follow me, come with me, the pen. So you have the pen, you have the sword, and you have the money. These are the three sort of tools for leading people in a certain direction. The military knows this, the church knows this, political leader knows this. Industry, business has just started to understand that storytelling is not any, you know, fluffy, sort of esoteric stuff. It's extremely powerful. Ask any ISIS follower or any member of Al-Qaeda what it is that holds the thing together. It's a story, and it's a hardcore story that holds any terrorist organization together and motivates them, drives them forward, even if they are under extreme pressure. We have now fully understood, also in business, the power of storytelling, whether it's IKEA or it's Northvolt or Toyota or any other organization. There has to be a coherent, clear-cut story that holds the system together. And if it's really good, that also holds the system of sub-suppliers together, the followers, so to say. So this is a rather late development that industry and business have understood that this is nothing just for religious people or artists or or oddballs. It's hardcore stuff. I used to say to my students, listen, the soft stuff is the hard stuff when it comes to storytelling and the words. Yeah. What seems to be the soft stuff is, in practice, the hard stuff.
You can now we have access and we can learn pretty much. I mean, if you want to code, you can learn how to code. If you want to, whatever, if you want to know how to build a kitchen stool, you can do that. You can, of course, practice and learn how to storytell. It's just that it's a skill that you need to practice with other people. You can't do it by yourself. And that softer element is indeed, and I can't stress enough, and I'm happy that you said it, the soft skills are the hard skills. It's a lot.
Yes, a transformation has happened. But I think there are so many examples out there today in the Momentum book. We take the example of President Zelensky of Ukraine and look at what the contribution that he has made, just as a very good communicator and a person able to summarize the situation, explain the direction by saying, no, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition, as a response to the Americans asking him whether they want him them to fly him out. And many, many other examples. But he, if you think Zelensky away and put in a less communicative person with bad English in a gray suit, Soviet style, mumbling, don't looking into a camera, you would see a completely different development, probably, both internally in Ukraine and the support for Ukraine's cause internationally. So I couldn't underestimate today or overestimate the power of storytelling.
And if we're to extrapolate this to companies, or to talk in general about companies, because to have the right story, to have the right vision, makes the difference in how your clients see you, whether they choose your product versus another product, like we discussed, right? The green steel versus not so green steel. I mean, it's we don't go and buy that in the supermarket, but we'll probably end up, and it's happening already in the Western world mostly for now, choose a pair of pants. You know, my kids, you know, there's a lot of, especially the young generation, they look, where is it from? How is it sourced and so on? My question is, how can companies do this in a conscious way, and particularly on the point of examples? If you have certain examples of companies that have done it really well, right, that have crafted this vision, and perhaps going a bit even deeper than the vision, because there's also a nuance here. Some talk a good game, like politicians, and then you dig a little bit under the surface and it's like, okay, it's mostly mumbo jumbo. Yeah. So yeah, over to you, Dr. Shell.
Yes, I see what you mean. Now, firstly, the world is, as we are speaking, falling to pieces. Falling to pieces in the sense that globalization is more a process now of fragmentization, and the world will probably be broken down into 5, 6, or 7 smaller worlds. China is one, a world increasingly of its own, with its own market, own technology, own internet, own everything. As of today, we trade with each other intensively still, Europe and China, China and the United States. But we should put a note to self that the world is driven increasingly in a direction where we live and work in one of these worlds, you and me. Russia is a world of its own. Everybody knows that as of today. With its friends, it has friends, but they form something together. What I'm saying is that the story doesn't have to be global anymore. The story is for Europeans or for Westerners, and there you can tell a story. IKEA is telling a story. They have left Russia completely, closed everything. They don't even sell one piece of furniture. They have no manufacturing there. They have nothing there. H&M is leaving China, both as a market and as a sub-supplier, developing increasingly a story about recycling clothes for their market, for their corner of the world. So what we will see is a localization of the stories. They will become local. They will be attractive to a certain group of listeners, not to everybody. The stories that we tell in many Western companies, they don't want to hear in China, or they don't want to hear it in Moscow either. Of course not, because it goes bang against the ideas that they have. So what I'm saying here is that 10 years ago, we tried to talk to the world. We developed stories and brands and stuff that should be able to work in all the way from Tokyo to Toronto. That is not the case anymore. And what we can see is how these stories now are becoming much more anchored in something that is geographically or ideologically a local process. I am not surprised that we move in that direction, but I think you can see it now in the business community how that is changing, that you're talking to fellow Western consumers, potential employees, and what have you, not to the Middle East or India or China.
Mm. And you work and advise a lot of boards and CEOs. What would be your one, two pieces of advice in the context of somehow, and I don't think there is a silver bullet, but somehow mitigating all these risks and disruptions and constant, you know, if you were a CEO, right, what would be one or two North Stars that you would focus on in the next couple of years?
Yes, I am advising a number of firms, and we call these worlds oligons. The seven worlds that are created now, we call them oligons. Why oligons? Because it's not regions. A region is a geographically structured area. An oligon is where you share an idea. Australia share the same idea as France and England. They are very far from each other geographically. New Zealand share the same kind of idea. Japan is a part of that kind of thinking. South Korea, you can say, is a part of the same oligon, but they are not geographically close to each other, but ideologically they are. You are asking for my advice. Do business within your oligon. Think your own world first for the foreseeable future. That's where you do the investments. That's where you find your prime sub-suppliers, and that's where you play the game, so to speak. The risks has increased tremendously to build up global supply chains. We have seen that now, and it has been tested one time, two times, three times. Global supply chains is playing a dangerous game. We see the return of the state. You cannot guarantee that you own things in a foreign country anymore because the state moves in and nationalizes. For the first time in 50, 60 years, the threat of nationalization is back. The advice is, of course, go light. If you go into a market outside your own world, go very, very light. Light in the sense that you don't have huge investments either in buildings, machinery, manufacturing. Find a local representative, do some business there, but be prepared to move out in less than 2 years or 2 months. Advice number three, keep an eye on these stories that we were talking about earlier, because increasingly, this is a world that is driven by words and what you see on a screen. Donald Trump, blah, 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 and picture of Trump. It's a Trumpification of the world, not in a political sense, but in a storytelling sense, that it's the picture, it's the film, and it's the words that gives you attraction, attention, and at the end of the day, enables you to play a commercial game also increasingly these days. Elon Musk is doing that to some extent with his companies, the Tesla company and SpaceX and what have you. Some people don't like this. It's a matter of taste, you know, and the products should talk for themselves, and this is not okay. I'm not sure that we should have that philosophical discussion for the moment. It's a commercial game that is changing. It's moving in this direction. Like it or not, we have to learn it.
Mm. I want to ask you on this point with storytelling, because with the AI and advancement, so from ChatGPT when it blew up last year at the early stage of last year, now this year, the next stage, it seems, of evolution, if you've seen, I'm sure you have, the text to video, which kind of blew me away, just the power. And again, we're talking 1 year, yeah? So within 1 year now, we give text and then you get a video out. Ultimately, AI can create stories and give meaning. And I mean, ultimately, stories build religions. Yeah, religions are built on stories. Whole cultures are built on stories. Ultimately, all of us live lives based on stories, not based on mathematical formulas. How do you see this playing out? Risks. I don't want to be doom and gloom a little bit, but I'd love your perspective because you've seen quite a few things. You know, when you look back, your predictions ended up being quite truthful. So I'd love your perspective on, will AI end up creating the stories that we will end up believing?
Right. Yes. Of course, we should talk about AI and technology in general. To cut a long story short, we are in a process of making intelligence a service. Just like music today is a service, Spotify and Apple Music provides a service. You pay and you get music, and you get all the music that we human beings have created for $10 a month or the equivalent thereof. It's a fantastic development. Streamed music, streamed video, Netflix, you pay 15 quids and then you have massive amounts of film. We do the same thing now with intelligence, with medical knowledge, financial knowledge, knowledge about distribution systems and logistics. It will be there. It's a service. You pay. And once you've paid, you have full access to all that we human beings ever have created. You can also ask the machine to put it together in the form of a poem or a small film about vaccines, if that is what you're after. Of course, we will be able to do that. The process is rather rapid. This is one side of the coin. The flip side of the coin is that we human beings contain something that has a name, a proper name in English. It's called silent knowledge or tacit knowledge, based on the simple fact that human beings know more. All human beings, we know more than we can say. Acupuncture you can't say, but you can do. But the acupuncturist cannot say what he or she is doing, why it is working, and there is no words for that. But you can do the acupuncture. You are for the moment in Singapore, so you have close to many acupuncturists. Now, this fact that we human beings have this silent knowledge is now in the process of changing education, higher education, competitive advantages, the political landscape. Why? Well, because the training now for a medical doctor is drifting towards the skill of being a medical doctor, not the knowledge in itself, because that can be streamed and intelligence is a service and medical knowledge becomes a service. But there is a skill of being a doctor. To comfort a dying patient is a skill. And that you cannot ask AI. I will read my lips when I say it. That machine will not be able to comfort a dying patient. That machine will not be able to discuss a cancer, a diagnosis that is possibly lethal with a patient. That skill is human. And it's a tacit knowledge. And we will drive now many professions in that direction. The legal profession will be more skill-based. Medical profession will be more skill-based. Businessmen and women and the financial market is drifting towards skills. The rest the machine can do. Machine trade, machine analysis, machine this and machine that. But to discuss risk and placement with a 73-year-old female client in Chicago is a skill. And her financial situation after her husband has died all of a sudden. That is a skill. And what kind of financial situation she actually is in, the machine will provide excellent components in the placement of the money and the resources. We take now the whole human project and drive it in the skill direction. And skills is an extremely human thing. The skill to paint, the skill to comfort, the skill to make love, the skill to dance. There are a lot of skills that we human beings have. Deeply, deeply human. These, the machines will free up a lot of time for us to be very human, to be more human than we ever have been. Dear listeners, the idea that 40% of all the young people in Great Britain and Germany and the United States should have a university degree is ridiculous because they don't work with university kind of stuff. They are machine substitutes. It's simple degrees they have that you can substitute away with a machine in 6 months. And that is what will happen now. A higher education is no more a free ride to high wages, a nice life. That is over since many, many, many years. But now we speed up the process dramatically with the help of AI. So what we're doing is that we are, as I use the word drifting, because drifting basically means that it's a little bit push, a little bit pull towards a more skill-based set of competitive advantages, educational processes, and what have you. That was a long answer. Sorry about that.
I love it. I'm going to get my wife to listen to this because I keep telling her. I mean, we have a 12-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son, and she's already talking about education and where they go for university. I'm like, I simply cannot see the need, not in the form that there is today, of our kids going to a university as it is today, unless it completely changes. And I hope it will. And I think it's due, long due, for an overhaul of our educational systems across the world. I think actually the Nordics are probably some of the most advanced in terms of making it a lot more practical. But yeah, I mean, when I went to school, I was asked to vomit information from a textbook, and I'm like, and I studied psychology, right? So I'm like, okay, but great. Struggling. But
there is a fantastic book was published recently. It's here on my desk, but this is the Swedish version, Head, Hand, and Heart. And we have 60, almost 100 years behind us when we are focused our educational system on head only. It's a head game. And the labor market is a matter of climbing as high as you can, and with primarily head-based skills. Hand and heart, we have not cared so much about. We haven't paid so much for it in the labor market. It hasn't been valued very much. And that's where we now, with the help of AI and the machines, we'll see rather dramatic redefinition, both of the labor market, the value of education, what kind of education we value, and the whole, it's like a complex of activities. I'm actually very optimistic that this will not only drive economic growth, because what we have ahead of us is probably a huge tsunami of economic growth driven by the greening of the planet and AI, which is high productivity and a necessity. We have to rebuild the industrial project. Logistics, cars, excavators, farming, everything we do, we have to do, redo, and do right. And we have about 40 years to do it. Everybody knows this. It has started, but we are just in the beginning. This will probably drive an economic growth that compares to nothing. Well, maybe the time after the Second World War, when we built up many countries after the world in Asia and Europe, because it's such a huge project. And it's technology, AI and friends, together with a huge need. And the need is to reduce carbon dioxide very quickly across the globe, in all the supply chains, products, services, etc. So there is a vision, you can say, and the technology that enables it. But it will also actually redefine the concept of being a human being in a very fundamental way, because we have pretended that we are machines in school and in business. We have pretended and competed with machines, trying to be like a machine, memorizing millions of things. We don't have to do that, and it's not very human to do it. Do the same kind of boring task every day as a financial advisor or working in an insurance company, studying applications for a pension scheme. Machine type of work, not very human.
Mm.
But we have upgraded many of those jobs and said, look, you are a global head of pension applications now. But my God, it's still, I mean.
Everybody in the bank, you know, Shell, everybody in the bank is VP. Like,
Rado, I understand that. It's like it's in other situations, you can give titles away because it's a cheap yes. way to upgrade people that they believe that they are important, but they are not. They are not. You're a VP of not very important things. You are a VP of not very human things. What the machines now do is that they will show us this in a very, very, very brutal and powerful way. They will hold up a mirror and say, look, I can do this instead of you. And I can do this, 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 this. And when we have stripped away all the things that these machines now can do, there will be a hardcore left, which is skill-based. And that hardcore, we will find in architecture, we will find it in accounting, we will find it in medicine and all areas where you and me or another human beings are active. But we will strip away much of that very non-human kind of work that we have been doing for so many years. Good for us, I would say. Good for us.
I'm gonna look for the book Head, Hand, Heart. Thanks for sharing. You definitely.
And the name of the author is David Goodhart. And British.
Goodhart. Oh, there we go. It's easy to. It's
yes.
easy
Goodhart.
To. Easy to remember. We have a few minutes left. I want to, and this has been phenomenally interesting. I want to take a few questions also and have the chance to ask you about the other book, The Monkey and
yes.
the Money. And you shared with me that you basically, it's a story. You can all see it. It's a story following the history of capitalism on the lens of an ape and the different stages through which it goes. Now, what's the threads? What's the kind of common threads through the centuries if you follow this monkey and the money? Because in many ways, I think we as humans, when it comes to money, we're kind of like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, the book tries basically to do one or two things. Number one, why? If now capitalism is bad, crazy, destroys the planet, all these things that have been said, capitalism, market economy has received a lot of criticism over the year, and many people hate it. Now, if you hate it very much, and if it's such a bad thing, why have we kept it? why don't we just scrap it and invent something better? This book explains why this machinery called the market economy or capitalism ever was created and why we don't get rid of it. Why it's superior to any other system that we have tried over thousands and thousands and thousands of years. It gives you that an intuitive understanding for that. So you will understand that, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. You will be okay. So that's why. That's the feeling you will have. Number two, this book shows also how this huge machinery called capitalism and market economy actually can be domesticated.
Mm.
It can use, it's like a huge, powerful dinosaur that you can domesticate and use for certain purposes. But then you have to understand the dinosaur. and what motivates the dinosaur. And that's what I show in this book, how the dinosaur actually can be domesticated and used for problem solving. Follow the ape all the way back in history to when we human beings all lived in Africa. And then we travel with the ape all the way into today and the future with bitcoins and oligons that we have discussed today and all the modern phenomena that we are surrounded by.
Final question. Bitcoin, cryptocurrencies. It's a topic that I'm sure that most people listening, some have invested, some maybe are still skeptical, but regardless, I think we are all curious how it's gonna pan out. What's your take? Will we be just paying with cryptocurrencies in the 3 to 5 year horizon, 10 year horizon? How is it gonna play out?
Some countries are already crypto countries. We're on the brink, on the verge of being that. Scandinavia and Sweden is one of them, probably together with China, the part of the world that is in the fourth. They will be backed by a nation. So yes, we will use crypto, but we will use crypto that is backed by a nation. There will be a nation in the backdrop backing the crypto Swedish crown. There will be a Chinese government and the Chinese central bank in the backdrop backing a crypto yuan. So yes, we will have the best of both worlds. We will use crypto, blockchain-based kind of technologies, but there will also be a backing by a nation state. Why? Because currencies that are not backed by a nation state get huge fluctuations. Enormous fluctuations. When there is no intent behind the currency and there is no one that has as a self-interest to keep that currency under control and stable, you get these fluctuations. And the fluctuations, you can make money. Yes, you can, but you can also lose. And most people don't want to save their money in Ethereum. And you don't want to save your money for two decades in Bitcoin. And you wouldn't advise your mother to place her money when she sells her house in Bitcoin as of today because of the fluctuations. But you would advise her to put it in a dollar denominated something. Why? Because there is a government in the United States that has a self-interest in controlling the fluctuations of the dollar. So, long answer to a short and powerful question that you had, we will have the best of both worlds. We will use what we have learned from the crypto world. We will back it either as nations or as regions and combine the two. And we are on the brink in some parts of the world of doing that now. The yuan, electronic yuan, is ready to go, and the Swedish krona is also ready to go. It's just now a matter of, I would say, months. Because up here in Scandinavia today, I haven't had money in my wallet personally for 2 years. Not even one krona, not even one. If I buy a chewing gum, I pay with the iPhone. Which means that the first step is already taken. Taxi, you pay with iPhone. Uber, you pay everything. Everything. And this is the first step in changing the human behavior, if you see what I mean, that you trust, because you have to trust the system. In some countries, people don't trust the system. It will take longer time. But here you can clearly see now where the first step is taken, and we are ready to go for the second. That you move towards a fully crypto-based currency solution. So yes, we are very, very close.
Well, Dr. Schell, this has been a roller coaster of information and insights for me, and I'm sure for the listeners. A pleasure to have you today, and many thanks for all the great insights and thought-provoking examples and sharing. And for taking the time to be with us today.
Thank you. And let me know if I should send you a monkey and the money, the name of the latest book, or if it's easier for you to have it through the ultra efficient Amazon.
Exactly. No, I'll get it through Kindle. Exactly. And you definitely got me curious, and as well as I urge everybody listening to check out Dr. Shel Nordstrom and his books on Amazon, because lots of wisdom there as well. Dr. Shel, pleasure, and thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.